Evening, Dan.
Evening, Omar. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Nice to get the show back on the road. How have you been?
It's fine. We've had a good post-season rest, I think. A lot more than most of the players would have had, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think this is... I saw an article, I think it was in The Guardian, that this is the first normal season, as it were, for since like 2018-19, because 1920 was affected by COVID, obviously. 2021 was also affected by COVID because it started late and so on. 21-22 still had kind of COVID postponements. And then last year we had the World Cup and the Queen and everything. Yeah, it feels like the players haven't had a rest, but we've done all right for ourselves.
Well, it's also the platforms change names in between as well. So, you know,
that is true. Yeah, I'm surprised it's still called a space, to be honest.
Well, who knows? It might not even be a space anymore soon, so we'll wait and see. But talking about sledgehammers looking for a nail. I think one of the things I'd love to chat to you about, only because it was something, a piece that you guys at the 21st Group wrote a few weeks ago now, especially because, I mean, I remember watching, it was one of the first games of the season. It was Brentford Spurs, I think, wasn't it? And the board came up for half time and there were 13 minutes of injury time, which I thought must be some type of Premier League record for the first half, but probably isn't. It then sort of prompted me to give a bit of thought and working out, especially because Varane has come out and talked about player load, and obviously because, just as we said, player resting in between seasons hadn't been brilliant in terms of being able to get some switch off time, and then I read your piece on injury time not being the solution, and it'd be just great to hear some of your thoughts on that, and then maybe we can sort of dig in a bit deeper.
Yeah, so I'm going to start with a bit of a tangent, which is a quote from a documentary about the Vietnam War, and I promise I'll bring it back to football. But there's an excellent documentary on the Vietnam War by Ken Burns. I think it's on Netflix, which you can watch. And I forget who said it was, like an American army general, and they were talking about essentially how America measured progress in the Vietnam War. And the one thing that US government military leaders focused on was the body count, basically, and how many people they'd killed in the war. And there was a general that said, when you can't measure what is important, you make what you can measure important, or words to that effect. That's kind of my feeling with the whole ball in play time thing. But ball in play time in football has forever pretty much always been around the kind of somewhere between the 50 and 60 minute mark. It's never really changed. I've been fortunate enough to work in Football Data for over 10 years, and I've seen data on ball in play time going back 15, 20 years, and it stayed, you know, pretty much as is over that whole period of time. It's as if suddenly people have realised that this is the metric that has been collected for a period of time, and are suddenly paying inordinate amounts of attention to it. And have realised that actually, you know, the ball isn't in play for 90 minutes, or it's not even in play for 60 minutes. And so I think there's become this obsession with ball in play time. I think it's very rare. I think people have gripes when after a game, if there's been time wasting. But I don't think people have gripes when there is a lack of ball in play time. And the reason I think those two things are distinct is because if you look at leagues and matches where ball in play time is high and where ball in play time is low, it's not really driven by time wasting. So if you take the Premier League and compare it to League Two, the Premier League has about 15%. I think something like 15% more ball in play time than League Two. It's about 7 minutes or so than League Two. And similarly, the Champions League is about 5% more ball in play time than the Premier League. And that's not because there's more or less time wasting more time wasting in League Two than there is in the Premier League, and the Premier League than the Champions League. It's driven primarily by the kind of quality of play on the pitch. But you don't find people who watch League Two games and come away thinking, oh, you know, the ball wasn't in play that long, I wasn't that happy with it. they'll come away from a League Two game or a Premier League game or a Champions League game unhappy because there was time wasting. And so the reference that you made at the top around sledgehammer looking for a nail, this to me feels like it, where people think that the ball in play time is low in the Premier League, 54 or so minutes last year, because the time wasting is just wrong. That's just the natural level of ball in play that happens in football matches. And I don't think you or I have ever been to a football match and have felt that, oh, I didn't get my money's worth because the ball was only in play for 50 minutes. You might feel you're not getting your money's worth because of time wasting, but that won't be the core driver of ball in play time. And so I think, essentially, you know, if you want to address time wasting, I think there is some stuff that has been implemented this year, which has been quite good. So there's more proactive yellow cards, and it kind of putting players on, you know, more jeopardy earlier in games, which I think is probably a good thing. I think the other solution, which I've tweeted about a number of times, which actually comes via Mark Clattenburg, is I think decisions should be reversed if you're time wasting. So if you're time wasting at a goal kick, then you concede a corner. If you're time wasting a throw in, the throw in goes the other way, and so on. So I think things like that, you know, which are quite punitive, which have kind of real sporting consequences more so than yellow cards, I think is ultimately the solution. And this isn't me just kind of, and I appreciate I've gone on here, but this isn't me just kind of having a rant about ball and play time. I do think there are consequences of some of the changes that have been made. First and foremost, the one which you mentioned at the top, which is that players are essentially spending more time on the field. You know, when we already know that there are issues around, you know, the intensity of games nowadays, given the kind of physical nature of football compared to 10, 15 years ago, added with the fixture congestion, is putting a lot of strain on players. And invariably, you're actually having a negative impact on ball and play time, ironically, because players are being stretched, they're either being injured or they're kind of, you know, tired, and therefore the technical quality falls. So, yeah, long-winded way, I suppose, of saying that I'm really not a fan of some of these new regulation changes, and I do feel that more subtle changes might have had the intended effect of trying to reduce time wasting.
My other thought, Omar, on obviously, I think that's fascinating, by the way, because I think it's very easy just to convolute the two specific points and then obviously, in a way, like some have done, and then go, well, we just need to disincentivize, but maybe perhaps not necessarily find the right incentives for that. But I also wondered whether there's a sort of a wider stakeholder point, which is I can't quite work out whether, for example, longer amounts of game time is beneficial for a broadcaster, for example. So would it be better for broadcasters to get more value for money, i.e. in terms of content time, because they're longer matches, or does that disrupt other things in terms of scheduling or otherwise? And then the second thing I had was whether actually this is something, you know, like a couple of seasons ago, VAR was, the bar for a VAR effectively intervention was a lot lower. And then suddenly that bar has intentionally or otherwise, consciously or unconsciously, risen quite significantly to only sort of make those clear and obvious errors, which are then very high in terms of that intervention, and whether that will actually sort of work its way through in terms of a natural equilibrium for that either time wasting or amount of injury time. Or, you know, a lot of people are suggesting this is here to stay, and that consistency of approach is going to only continue.
Yeah, on the latter point, I guess that's the hope, but you mentioned the kind of 13 minutes on the Spurs game. And look, maybe there was 13 minutes of delay, but it certainly wasn't that first half. There certainly wasn't any time wasting, right, from either team. You know, that tends to be more of a second half phenomenon. And I don't think, if I remember correctly, there was anything. So, yeah, I don't know, to be honest, how that'll happen. I think your first point on broadcasters is a really interesting one. I don't have any kind of in-the-know perspective on that, but I know any sporting event that has ambiguous length of match or game is unappealing for broadcasters. I mean, tennis is the most extreme and common case where broadcasting tennis, the value of tennis to broadcasters is lower than it might otherwise be, because you just don't know where matches are going to be played and ended. And there was a thing about Andy Murray talking about that actually just yesterday in the US Open, talking about the Wimbledon scheduling. So obviously football's not to that extreme. You're not talking about games that could last anywhere between 3 and 5 hours. like in tennis. But equally, you know, you're finding Premier League games kicking off at, what is it, 2 o'clock on a Sunday, beginning to bleed into the 4:30 kickoff. There's no time for preview content, or even sometimes it might even, you know, actually start into those games if you've got, you know, 10, 15 minutes, 15 minute halftime breaks and so on. So, yeah, ultimately, actually, I think the broadcasters will have a say in this, because that's where the money in the game comes from. So it'll be interesting to see what their perspective is as it kind of plays out over the season.
Next one I had, Omar, and it was only because I felt very privileged to be invited to your World Cup WhatsApp group over the Women's World Cup period, where the 21st group, maybe this is just a 21st group walking half an hour advert, but I think you'll take that, where you guys were giving some brilliant stats around favorites, around predictions, around matchups, around how the possibility of upsets increased or decreased, bearing in mind certain results that were happening. But what seemed to be clear from all of the stats and all of the great content that you were providing to that WhatsApp group in particular, and then on some of the pieces you've done subsequently, is feels like, at least anyway, sort of demonstrating a pretty significant change in the sort of competitiveness of women's football, if that's right. And you were sort of, me reading between the lines, it sort of suggested that that was sort of characterized by the either the number of upsets, whether that's just an outlier in itself, or actually it's a greater trend of, again, greater competitiveness between teams, especially in the opening rounds, which I think, if I'm correct, without spoiling anything, Omar, led to what you thought in the outset was possibly one of the more likely finals, which was England-Spain, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, I think you covered the kind of main themes of the tournament really well there. And by the way, all four a TFG advert, but hopefully, as you say, the content is interesting. Yeah, so it was, I have to say, I was really pleasantly surprised by how competitive the World Cup was. Obviously the tournament was expanded, and I had fears about the number of teams that would be competitive. And we did a metric on the number of teams that we considered competitive, i.e. would have a kind of fighting chance of playing against the best team in the tournament, which we'll get onto in our money, was Spain. We had 24 of the 32 teams were competitive with Spain. Whereas at the 2019 World Cup, of the 24 teams, only 15 were competitive with the US. And it was partly the US regressing, which we'll get onto. But clearly, you know, having 24 teams that were competitive, as a men's benchmark, we had 30 of the 32 competitive. So given that we had at the last World Cup, I can't remember what the Thailand-US scoreline was, but it was something crazy. We didn't really have any of that in this tournament. I thought that was a really promising shift. The other shift, obviously, was Spain being, in our model, the favourites, and very easy to say that after the tournament, but we did share it on social, and we were, I think, one of very few that had Spain as tournament favourites, and that was after us even accounting for the players that obviously dropped out of the squad before the tournament. They still had, you know, a number of really high quality players, and so we rated them really highly going to the tournament. Still only 20% to win pre-tournament, but favourites ahead of the US, who were 16%, England 15%. We also, our view is that the injuries hadn't hurt England too much, because the depth was reasonably good in the first team squad. They'd have been 16% essentially joint second favourites before the tournament. They dropped to 15% with Williamson, Kirby and Mead being out, because they had replacements like Lauren James, obviously, who played really well. And then, yeah, as the tournament progressed, I think there were some really kind of interesting themes that emerged. I mean, the first one is obviously the kind of decline of the US. And what was interesting was that Germany going out early, we've got a player model. And even though the Germans went out early, which perhaps they're a little bit unlucky, but certainly obviously didn't quite play to their potential, but actually they've got more of the top 100 best under 23 players in the world than the US. So do Spain, so do France, so do Brazil and the Netherlands. So the US have definitely dropped off. And I think there's kind of questions to be asked now about what the NWSL model looks like from a kind of player development perspective, how that fits in with college, and whether that can compete with the European model of academies, and obviously all the funding that comes from from the men's side of the game over the last few years. So I think that's a really interesting trend. It'll be interesting to see where the US get to over the next cycle of the tournament. And then, yeah, more broadly, the final itself we had as a really kind of close matchup of all men's and women's finals in the last 50 or 60 years or so. We had this as had the England-Spain game as an absolute toss-up. The only closer final in our model was the 1990 final between Germany or West Germany and Argentina. And I thought it was a good final. It was competitive. Obviously, I think Spain were probably just about the better team on the day, but. Yeah, we'll definitely have to talk about what happened after the final in the coming weeks, and I think we've got a few people in mind who would like to speak to and get their perspective on everything around Rubiales and Hermoso and so on. But from a footballing perspective, I thought it was an outstanding tournament and really pleased that it kind of caught the attention of the world, particularly given the time zones weren't particularly helpful for the traditional audience of women's football.
No, I definitely think so. And yeah, as I said, we're going to try and get on a couple of people much more knowledgeable than us. Not doubting your knowledge, Omar, on particular Spanish demographics. But yeah, I think it's obviously a very, very difficult subject to talk about, actually, simply because it's completely, unfortunately, overshadowed what was, I think, one of the great final performances, actually, I think, of Spain. I think you were probably a bit kind to England in the truth. My view is that Spain, for long periods, controlled that game brilliantly, pressed incredibly, and England couldn't get out of the press, really, and could only go long to a degree. So I really thought it was a great game, but no one's remembering that game now, unfortunately, and it's completely overshadowed by an absolute travesty of a week for Spanish football. And hopefully taking it on a slightly lighter note now, the interesting thing that you said about the NWSL and the pathways was, I was thinking about it the other day with two of the Lionesses, one Alessia Russo and one and Lotta Wubin Moy, both actually went on the college platform. I think they were in North Carolina for their education and their training, and then only then came back to the WSL. So I think, and maybe they are the outliers. I'm not, not quite sure. It'd be interesting. I see Valente, who are actually Les's agency, are on, so maybe we can get them involved at another date as well on this chat. But I wonder whether those two are the outliers, or whether that's actually now more of a potential path for young UK athletes, young UK footballers to still go on that college path, or actually whether the UK pathway to the WSL is strong enough, bearing in mind the next gen of especially girls and women that are going to come through and obviously compete as things improve.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the US at the moment, we've done some analysis on this, is that they have incredible depth of talent. So, the 100th best American woman is much better than the 100th best Spanish or English or German woman. And I think that is a function of the college pathways and obviously a function of participation in the US and the amount of women and girls who play the game. One thing, and it may just be a generational thing, they haven't kind of developed the same elite crop that is as good as particularly the Spanish, but also to a degree England and Germany, that kind of elite crop of players. So yeah, the challenging thing with all this is very difficult. You have a point in time, it's very easy to react to a World Cup and say everything's a crisis, as a lot of sports often do. But I think it was noticeable that, clearly the US team didn't perform as well. And clearly the European teams have caught up, and actually even, teams outside of Europe were more competitive than ever. And when you've got these global pathways for players, you've got the Colombian players, her name's Caicedo, playing for Real Madrid. You've got Zambian players playing in the Spanish league as well. Like that global pathway and that mixing of talent in European leagues, which the US doesn't really have at the moment, I think will long-term provide a bit of a competitive advantage for European teams.
Really good. Well, we've got a little bit more time to go. And 9 minutes and counting. So no pressure at all, Omar, to deliver some very insightful stuff in a short period of time. I know that's what you do very well. But three games into the Premier League now we are. And I know 21st Group, you're always coming up with innovative projections based on the EPL starts. How are things looking? I know I said to you in our prep call beforehand, was it quite an outlier that so many clubs so far are on 0 points? You sort of retorted, no, that was actually quite usual. So you put me in my box pretty quickly. But just really interested to hear sort of anything either out of the ordinary or is it business like usual with City 3 wins from 3 and looking pretty good already?
Yeah, well, I suppose the other thing about teams on 0 points after 3 games, that two of them actually haven't played 3 games yet, actually Burnley and Luton, because obviously that game's postponed. So yeah, I may be wrong, but I don't think it's that out of the ordinary. It's an interesting one. I don't know how excited or interested to be in the Premier League title race this season. We've got Man City as 70% favourites for the league. I think they're pretty similar on the betting markets. We actually did a piece this morning, which went out on our mail shop, will be on our website soon, around the scheduling of the league and when the two title favourites are set to meet in the second half of the season. And actually in the Premier League, they're meeting, I think, Liverpool, who are our second favourites, are meeting City with about 10 weeks to go, which is relatively far out. I think it's maybe a little bit further out from the end of the season than it has been in previous seasons, maybe by 1 or 2 game weeks. And that's a reflection of, I think, you know, needing to have those games having still something riding on them. And by that point in the season, maybe Man City are probably projected to be 6 or 7 points clear. If Liverpool can win, they can kind of reel them into 4 or 5. That's kind of obviously talking very hypothetically in the future, but it's interesting to think about how you might schedule the competitions. Whereas in Italy, it's a real dead heat. Obviously Italian title races in the last few years, or certainly the unpredictability of the Serie A has been really good in the last few years. And we've got Inter on 34%, Napoli on 31%, and they're due to meet in game week 36, I think it is. So 2 weeks out from the end of the season. So that could be a real title decider. But yeah, otherwise in the Premier League, we'll see how it plays out. I think City are strong favourites. And then we've got a whole range of teams who have, call it, more than a 1 in 6 chance of making the Champions League. And that's the Champions League top four. We've also got it a 90% chance that fifth will be a Champions League place based on how England performs in European competitions this season, which is maybe something we can update periodically on this. But obviously, there's an extra spot going to the top two leagues who perform best in Europe in any given season. So, you know, you're actually looking at almost half the league actually with a 1 in 6 chance of playing in the Champions League next year, which is you know, an amazing opportunity for all those teams. And then finally at the bottom, I think there's probably a couple of teams that are feeling a little bit fortunate that, you know, Luton, obviously they've done amazing to come up, but they're pretty strong favourites to go down. Sheffield United, similarly, although not quite as stark as Luton. So there are probably 5 or 6 different teams looking at, call it, 1, 1.5 spots to avoid in the drop zone. So I think, unlike last season, where I think it was obviously very, very open and you had 3 established Premier League teams going down, this year, I think, is a bit different. Obviously, the Championship's the league that is looking perhaps a little less competitive than what it normally is.
Does that mean, Omar, that it's more likely that a lower points total will keep you up, or am I just counterintuitively thinking that incorrectly?
Yeah, good question, actually. I don't think necessarily, because I mean, if it plays out that Sheffield United and Luton are kind of teams that lose relatively regularly, I think it will still be around that kind of 35, 36 point mark that would keep you up, on the basis that you would need to beat those teams to stay up. So I still think it would be pretty much around the same. And then shall we squeeze in the last bit on agent regs, Dan? So I know there's going to be a verdict soon as it relates to anti-competitiveness of some of the regs. Maybe it's worth teeing that up, because I think we'll definitely go into more. And obviously this is this is really pertinent because we're 2 days out from the end of the window, and there's a lot of activity happening as it relates to transfers before some of these new regs potentially come in.
Yeah, exactly. And so backtrack for 30 seconds. This is the last window where agents don't need to be regulated by FIFA and effectively pass the exam. So query whether the increased activity or what feels like an increased activity is potentially due to that. Query whether it's to do with agents also wanting to ensure the higher commission rates because there's a commission cap coming in too. Query whether agents are looking to actually protect the players because players from the next window will have to start paying their agents directly, which can have quite significant detrimental tax implications. But apart from all of that, yeah, there's it's in the public domain, but there will be a decision in the English arbitration provisions under the FA rules as to the anti-competitive nature of the FIFA regulations. That will have probably significant implications for whether the rules can even be implemented, because a lot of my clients are asking, well, do I need to take the exam? Are the rules even going to be implemented? Obviously, they must be anti-competitive and illegal. But there have been lots of court cases, as we talked about previously, throughout Europe and beyond, which have either backed FIFA to some degree. But there has been a German court case which has at least temporarily suspended the implementation of the FIFA regs pending a FIFA appeal. So we're in a little bit of a no man's land at the moment, where we're waiting for a UK decision which could have seismic implications on the implementation of the rules, i.e. they might not be implemented. And at the same time, we've also got the FA, the English FA, consulting on their regs to be implemented based on the FIFA regulations. So there's lots of complications. There's lots of new drafting going into contracts before the end of this window to make sure then that contracts and agreements may or may not be compliant with whatever sets of rules come in or don't come in at certain points. So you can imagine the headaches that I'm having at the moment, trying to make sure everything's compliant at present, make sure everything might be compliant with potentially two different sets of rules from the 1st of October onwards. And also trying to help actually quite a lot of agents now with the preparation for passing the exam, which is in mid-September. Because if the agents don't pass the exam by mid-September, there's then the risk that they obviously won't be able to undertake agents' activities for the January window, which obviously will have significant implications. So lots to ponder and consider. We can definitely do another session at the right time on this, but the next few weeks after the window are actually going to be pretty crucial for how agents are going to operate for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, definitely cover that in more depth, and yeah, it'd be really fascinating to see how the verdicts play out and how the market changes as well as a consequence. But yeah, as you say, we'll cover that in more depth.
Perfect. Well, before we go, and because this is usually the first one of the show for the season, can we go with champions and relegation predictions that I always get wrong and you usually get right?
I think it's fairly straightforward. I think City win the league. I think Luton and Sheffield United go down, and I think they are joined by... Oh, that's a tricky one. I'll go Bournemouth, but not with any great deal of confidence.
This might be incredibly controversial and won't be happy with a few of my work colleagues, but I just think Everton are looking terrible at the moment.
Yeah, I couldn't bring myself to say Everton. I think it's looking great at the moment, mate.
Perfect. Well, mate, it's great to be back. Great to chat. Football is always with you, and looking forward to lots of great conversation for the season ahead.
Yeah, nice one. All right, cheers, Dan.
Thanks for listening. You can follow me on Twitter, TikTok and Instagram at Football Law, read my blogs and listen to my previous podcasts via my website, danielg.com/blogs. Please do subscribe to the Done Deal Football Podcast, like, share and tag me. If you like the content, if not my voice, you'll probably also like my book Done Deal, an insider's guide to football contracts, multi-million pound transfers and Premier League big business. A bit of a mouthful. It's available to buy in hard copy, digitally, and via Audible. All links are in the podcast show notes. Lastly, the podcast is powered by 13, which is a fashion brand I've started. All proceeds go towards cancer charity research, and particularly the stellar work done by John Krell, who has helped my mum through some difficult times over the last few years. You can take a look at the merch and hopefully buy a t-shirt, hoodie, cap, or all three. Please do spread the word and go to 13shop.co.uk. That's 13shop.co.uk. Thanks for listening.